I'm going to use this video. Oh, God, look at my hair. I'm going to use this video because I started a channel and I said, why not? I might as well. And if people want to watch this on YouTube, they can. So this will be a full episode on YouTube with my terrible backdrop. But Gabriel, welcome back. I like that. Oh, it's good. It's good. I like that. We welcome back to the show. Gabriel, you have been on the show a couple times now. You and you're officially now a friend of the family. Congratulations. You've been adopted into the East as a podcast collection of orphans and radicals. We always appreciate that here at the show. But we are here to talk about Zizek and an interesting article that you published at the beginning of this month, earlier this month. And it's gotten a lot of attention. I mean, obviously, something like this is going to get a lot of attention because, you know, and obviously this is a topic we have to go up, but like Zizek is a big name. And when you go after like a, not go after is the bad word, especially because it makes it sound, but like when you critique, because that's a smarter way of saying, but like when you take up a critique of like a big name, you benefit, so to speak, with the engagement of that big name's following. So if you take up somebody who doesn't have a following, then you're not going to get as much engagement. And this is just the basic law of internet celebrity and criticism in general, is that like the bigger the target, you know, the sort of more in theory you're going to get in terms of like, you know, readers or something like that. But putting aside that question right now, can you talk about, for people who don't know who Slavoj Žižek is, can you give us a brief, you've delved into his work and you explain you've known his work for quite a while and you've also like had professional interactions with him. So you're coming at this from a position of expertise. So maybe give us a light rundown of case people who don't know what he is and what he does and what his shtick is. And I think shtick is like the key word here. But, and also maybe in general, kind of explain, maybe because people might not get Lacanian, like the Lacanian psychoanalytic school, and it's like, and it's kind of basic contours. So that might be cool too, if you can kind of weave those together, because I know you spent a lot of time with these texts over the years. So I'm sure this is going to be, I'm sure you're able to sort of give us a kind of rundown of what's at stake.
Yeah. Well, I imagine a lot of your viewers and listeners already know something about Zizek and have encountered him as the way in which he has been promoted within the global theory industry. And that is as someone who's a radical, a Marxist, who is the most dangerous philosopher in the world, sometimes he's referred to as. And what's interesting about his own trajectory is he comes out of a very explicit commitment to anti-communism in Yugoslavia. He, you know, came up in Yugoslavia when it was socialist, was part of the quote-unquote dissident movement, which meant that he was an anti-communist and he was organizing on that front and drawing specifically on French theory that was inspired by Heidegger. Heidegger, of course, most people know, is an unrepentant Nazi, and a lot of the French philosophy that was drawing on Heidegger or in dialogue with him in various ways was also very explicitly, like Heidegger himself, anti-communist. And so Zizek kind of had his start within this milieu of a French theory-inflected anti-communism and an attempt to bridge a kind of divide that is often present between theory and political practice. And one of the ways in which he did that is he founded a political party, or co-founded a political party, a liberal political party in Yugoslavia. And after working as a columnist for Mladina, which is a weekly magazine very widely read in Yugoslavia that was part of the dissident movement. And actually, Zizek was their primary weekly correspondent. He was their political commentator. And that magazine was accused by the Yugoslav Communist Party in a very detailed report as being backed by the CIA. And this would not be surprising if it was indeed the case. I mean, I have not read the report myself. I don't have the language skills and I don't know all of the details, but it makes perfect sense because, of course, the Central Intelligence Agency and the U.S. National Security State in general was involved in anti-communist destabilization campaigns across the, you know, Eastern Bloc, former Soviet Union, etc. And so Zizek was first involved in this kind of dissident French theory-oriented movement and then founded or co-founded this liberal party, actually ran for the president of the country, was almost elected on this ticket. And the ticket of this party was for planned privatizations, the integration into Europe, the European Union, that is, integration into NATO, And so it was very much a pro-capitalist, pro-imperialist political party that was anti-communist. And he not only like co-founded this party, ran on its ticket, but then he is on record saying that he supported it for the first 10 years of its existence. And so what's kind of interesting about the evolution of Žižek is that within the former Yugoslavia, he played this kind of political and also theoretical role. But the way in which he rose within the Western world and the larger global theory industry was largely mediated by a phenomenon that's kind of described as radical democracy, or the movement called radical democracy. It's affiliated with Ernesto Laclau, Chantal Mouffe, and other people like this, that basically consisted in saying, well, you know, let's not look into socialism and Marxism and communism, but let's instead take democracy and kind of radicalize it in some ways. And there are very strong kind of anarchist elements within radical democracy. Jacques Rancière would be another example of someone who's also often classified in that category. And Žižek himself then collaborated with Ernesto Laclau, and who helped, you know, publish his first book, and Chantal Mouffe, and rose to fame as a kind of radical democracy liberal, but at the same time, a native informant from the East, right? So he was from the former, or what would become the former Soviet bloc, and therefore was presented as someone who kind of knew what socialism was from the inside. And so he very quickly pivoted from an embrace of post-Marxism, which is just a fancy way of saying anti-Marxism, to a rebranding as a radical Marxist who really knew what kind of communism was from the inside, or socialism was from the inside. And a lot of that did have to do with his relationship to Lacanian psychoanalysis. This would take a little while to unpack, but one of the things that's important to understand about Žižek is that just as some earlier theoretical traditions, like I was on your show and we talked about the Frankfurt School of Critical Theory, and they tried to merge Marxism with Freudianism, developing a kind of Freudo-Marxism. And what Žižek does is he emerges out of Althusser, who was a Marxist, but then also Lacanian psychoanalysis. So there's again this kind of later 20th century attempt to bring together Marxism and psychoanalysis. But we should note, of course, that psychoanalysis is the way in which it was developed by Freud and Lacan emerges within a worldview that is capitalist, that is colonial, that is patriarchal, and there are very important critiques of psychoanalysis for anything from Eurocentrism to its positions on the colonial question to its conservative political views and other such things. So basically you're bringing two discourses together that themselves are incompatible because there are different worldviews and there are different ideologies, which is not at all to say that we shouldn't be interested in psychology or psychoanalysis or other such things. It's just that in order to do that, you have to take seriously an analysis of the social totality via a Marxist lens of analysis. And that's not what people like Žižek do. The primary orientation is Lacanian. And so he takes Lacan's framework, which he kind of reinterprets, and uses it as a heuristic device to then interpret the social world and cultural products within the social world. So it could be films, it could be a porn site, it could be whatever, you name it. And he's going to find some type of Lacanian elements that are operative therein. And so it also reveals his kind of anti-Marxism, because he doesn't do historical and materialist analysis. Instead, he's a cultural consumer who has a pre-established theoretical framework. It's basically his reinterpretation of Lacan that then he'll find in Hitchcock, he'll find in, you know, Starbucks on the back of a coffee cup or whatever. He'll find it wherever he looks. And so that's kind of in a nutshell, I think, how we can situate Žižek as this quote-unquote native informant from the East who is a post-Marxist who rebrands himself as a radical Marxist, but is actually just, you know, the Marxism that he purports to embrace is very thin cover for a Lacanianism, and ultimately for some very, very reactionary political views, some of which I'm sure we'll get into.
Yeah, that is a very good, succinct introduction. I think there's a lot of different angles that I think we could go at this. I mean, people should read the article. It's a very, as you did before the Frankfurt School, you always sort of collect your receipts. You're a very close and like meticulous reader of this stuff. I wanted to push back a little bit on like fusing together different schools of contradictory thought. I mean, I feel like you can do a lot of different things, but they don't necessarily have to be reactionary. I think that in some ways, the story of Žižek, and I understand, I agree with you generally with the critique that you're posing, and I think it's hard to disagree because you show it all, is that you're talking about a moment of reactionary, a kind of reactionary spiking of the football of the 80s and 90s and the 2000s, right? Where the everyone got to say, oh, look, we told you communism would fall. We told you disgusting that these like, you know, disgusting communists were like the way are going to be their downfall. Look at them all. They're all drinking Coca-Cola and, you know, and they were all like quasi celebrating the downfall of Russia. And like, you know, obviously like, oh, look at them. They lost 10 years or 15 years off their life expectancy. Like that's kind of like the crass world of like American, like the culture. And I don't think that, I think if there's a story to learn from Žižek is that like the so-called intellectual or academic world isn't immune from any of that. Is that the same currents that affect, say, I don't know, like shock jocks and like public radio and like radio waves also affect like the things that happen in academia? And so if you have this guy who shows up and talks and is very animated and he doesn't seem like your average, you know, like academic and philosopher, he doesn't seem like your average Lacanian, which one of the things about Lacanians is that this is such rarefied material, and this is not a judgment. I think this is, I mean, whatever. Who am I to judge what people read and what people obsess over? Like, whatever. Like, who am I to say? But what you can't deny about it is that we're talking about a professional school, a tiny professional school of readers. Like, nobody voluntarily reads Lacan. Like, they do it as part of a professional program, even if it's like a graduate student. Like, that's still part of an institution, right? Like, no, you're, and so in some ways you could say that, you know, that this is just like a very rarefied example of an academic, of like what academia is, which is like a collection of pretty cut off fields that sometimes interact, that don't interact. Now, I think before we continue, I have a bigger sort of like bigger question about like, what is academic celebrity and what is celebrity? But before we get there, I want you to read, I want us to talk about your basic sort of thesis in the article, which is, you know, roughly halfway down or a third of the way. And it's under the subtitle Commie Cosplay. And you say, Žižek is neoliberal capitalism's court jester. Aping the figure of the Marxist qua antisocial fanatic, he encourages disdain for the real-world project of socialism while hawking the wares of Western consumer society through his pop-cultural mashup. The histrionic show put on by his contumacious, I've never heard that word, enfant terrible is We Must Never Forget on the capitalist stage. The trickster is just a hireling and a telling symptom of neoliberalism's cultural apparatus. It is this capitalist court, it is the capitalist court that has made the Joker into a superstar precisely because he has played his part so well. Like all good jesters, he pushes the limits of courtly decorum and says the most outrageous thing in a hysterical spectacle of critique, while ultimately towing the most important line by demonstrating his fealty to the puppet master. I know you put in parentheses King Capital. So this is, I think you're spot on here in terms of the kind of brand, to put it, I think, in a term that's correct, crassly correct for Žižek, the brand he's developed within academia, Western academia, because everybody develops a brand, and his is particularly unique and has sold well. And I was thinking here about, like, you know, does the age-old question about the jester is that, like, who's really in control of that scene? The jester who's performing for these people and making these people laugh, or the fact that it's the people in power who are hiring and controlling this guy who have the ability to turn on this entertainment for show. Like, who's, people like to think that the jester is the one who is courageous enough to like speak truth. But in reality, the material relationship is one of the powerful people hiring someone to say outrageous things about this supposedly outrageous topic, AKA communism.
Make one point extremely clearly. I think that the communism of the 20th century, more specifically all the network of phenomena we refer to as Stalinism, are maybe the worst ideological, political, ethical, social, and so on catastrophe in the history of humanity. And for me, it's a
I find that hard to accept. I mean, you wrote in a recent... Well, you say it now, but you've written many different things. You wrote, for example, quote, better the worst Stalinist terror than the most liberal capitalist democracy. Those words taken from one of your books.
Okay, I will not go now. It will take half an hour to explain how... to explain how I mean this. I meant simply that the communist regime started as a way of, through the revolution, of opening a space outside the existing capitalist ideology and so on and so on. But then, as I always emphasize, things went terribly, terribly wrong. Even if I may make a counter quote. I even claim that if you measure at some abstract level of suffering, Stalinism was arguably worse than Nazism, because even in the worst of Nazism, the victims were somehow, selected according to some criteria, if you were a Jew, a communist, whatever. In Soviet Union in the late 30s, the contingency was total. The party started to eat itself. Everyone... if you were, the most dangerous place to be was almost at the top of the nomenclatura. So my obsession almost with Stalinism is there is something so mysterious that went on there that we cannot yet really even explain it. Fascism is much easier to account for in the terms of the crisis of capitalism than the fascist dream of alternate modernity. That is to say, you remain capitalist, but with an authoritarian structure and so on.
So can we be clear then? In your view, was or was not communism a catastrophic failure?
Total failure.
No, that's precisely it. And I'm glad that you drew our attention to that particular section, because it goes to the heart of the argument. It's not an ad hominem attack on Žižek as a person or even as an individual. It is really situating him as a product of a particular system. And one of the reasons that Žižek is interesting from a social and political perspective is precisely because he reveals certain elements of the evolution of what I refer to in this paragraph as the cultural apparatus. So the cultural apparatus, I'm borrowing this from Brecht and other people who use terminology like this, is this system of cultural production, but also of distribution and consumption. It's the entire system that produces the cultural elements that we have, circulates them in the social world, and then makes them available for consumption. And it's very important, and that's a big part of my work, that we recognize that theory has an industry, just like clothing has an industry, or movies have an industry. And the way in which theory is produced, particularly the theory that's highly visible within the capitalist world, is not simply based on what individuals want to put out there in the world. It's based on a set of very deep material relations between the foundations and the think tanks and the universities and the publishing houses and all of this material system of production, circulation, and consumption. And then individuals who give things to the system or perform for the system in various ways. And if they do it well, then they advance within that system. And if they don't, then they're shut down. And in the case of someone like Žižek, he is a product of that system who has been so elevated within the capitalist cultural apparatus precisely because he has been able to give to the system precisely what it needs and wants at very particular points in time. So another part of the argument is that just as there was the kind of argument about the end of history that was so widespread in the 1990s around Francis Fukuyama and whatnot, there was also, and this was a core argument for a lot of the liberals and conservatives, there was also the production of a rad lib discourse, so a radical discourse that's actually a liberal discourse. So it's not a Marxist discourse, it's not a revolutionary discourse, it's a radical liberal discourse whose target audience is usually, at least in the case of Žižek, it's kind of young people and students, people who might be open to radical ideas or system change and recognize that we do need really profound changes. But what Žižek is able to give to the system is a version of kind of rad lib theory that gets people excited, that makes them think that something is radically changing, while in fact he actually shores up the status quo in very, very profound ways. And so to come back to the metaphor of the jester, I think that this really sums up who the person is, right? He's giving to the court exactly what it wants and needs. And in spite of the fact that he's so rebellious, he's this kind of rebel without a cause, and or a rebel with a lost cause, because he's so in favor of presenting communism as a lost cause. And he presents himself as someone who's, you know, breaking all the rules of decorum, and he's raunchy and he's raw. And this is the way in which the theory industry has kind of marketed him, and he's marketed himself, and that we have to see it from this higher level, not from the level of the individual subject and what they're producing, but from the objective level of the system, of the cultural apparatus that has produced an individual who's giving to that system precisely what they want. And it's interesting in this regard, because as you can imagine, having published a piece like this, some people had their feathers ruffled. And one of the very interesting dynamics in the people who got their feathers ruffled is that they are precisely people who participate in the Žižekian franchise, meaning that their own careers, their publication platforms have invested in him and have received symbolic and financial rewards from that investment. And so when somebody points out that this guy is a sham and a jester, they're going to circle the wagons and say, no, he's not, because of the way in which they're profiting from the jester, and they're actually part of that bourgeois cultural apparatus that he's feeding with this rad-lib discourse whose ultimate purpose is to shore up the compatible left and inoculate people against the idea that socialism could be something that would be instantiated in the very real world and that would be of value because it would fight back against the war of capital against labor, the war of the capitalists against working people around the world.
Yeah, I think that if there's anything, I kind of want to keep diving into this stuff because, you know, I think in some ways we had this conversation over the Frankfurt School too, is that like, you know, you're the sort of the crux of your method, I feel that, like, at least in some ways, at least in this article, at least the critique, and which is totally, I get it, like, it makes sense to me, the method that you're using, which is like, okay, here is this group of people who are associated with this project called like Radical Critique, right? Who are like, for instance, in Verso, like the books are called the Radical Thinkers series, literally. That's the name of their series, right? So like, this is a branding exercise, that like a canonization exercise. I just did an episode actually with Catherine Liu on the sort of making of canons. And like, yeah, this is how canons get made. They get made by material forces, publication, you know, publication schedules, editors in buildings in London and New York. Like these aren't just like ephemeral things that like the public sphere determines. Like there's no organic, like it's marketing. It's like, oh, this works. People like this stuff. Let's give him more. And I know this from like online market, like this is the way like online content machine works too, is that like somebody becomes popular and people get a ton of invites and they come and they just, and you get, and you feed the beast. Now, in the difference between someone like Žižek and like people online, right, the nature of the content doesn't have much behind it, right? Like when people talk online, there's like data left behind, and it's, people get the sense, and it's true, it's that it's ephemeral. However, because Žižek comes from this as an intellectual, right? As like, he's branded as an intellectual because it's like scholarship, because he's training, all this stuff. Like, because it's that the nature of the commodity itself takes on this rarefied force. But in the end, like a guy like Žižek isn't that much different than me, right? He just talks. Like he talks, he goes places and he talks. Like that's not like a bad thing. That's not like it's better than going and like destroying the planet or like being part of Deloitte or something. Like if people just talked for a living, we'd have a lot fewer problems. But like ultimately, like there's we're talking about a sausage, and you kind of make the thing about sausage. But like there is this thing that, and taking it back to the sort of to round out my question, is that like you're using this method of, let's assess these people who are deemed to be radicals. Let's assess them according to their political positions on divisive issues that are, you know, like in some ways like what's the word I'm looking for, like a litmus test of one's political beliefs, whether that's a fair thing or not, like I don't know, like we can argue about that. However, that is your method, and I feel like it's completely valid, and I feel like what you do is that I think I'd use this term last time too, is that you kind of subject these people to these stress tests. That like, oh, let's see what you say about, you know, whatever topic X, like, let's see what you have. And like, you've collected quite quite a few things, quite a few damning, like, for a guy who claims to be leftist, for a guy who, like, claims all these things, about whatever that even means. Like, I don't even think that means anything. And even, like, the notion of leftism is such, like, a vague and empty signifier. And I think guys like Zizek sort of, like, revel in this, is that you can talk about anti-capitalism and still align with, you know, the basic foreign policy alignment of the State Department, right? And that's a common thing. That's the thing. Zizek is not the norm. Zizek is not some exception to some broader rule. He's like, he's just a normie. He's just weird, though. Like, he talks about horny things. He's like spitting. He's like, you know, always like compulsively touching his face. Like, people, like, there's a weird, like, look at that disgusting, unattractive, like, weirdo troll who happens to use big words. Like, I don't know. That's not, I feel like maybe I'm telling on myself, and like, that's how I subconsciously view him. But like, that's that, I can't help but feel that, like, part of like the nature of Zizek's sort of like cultural commodity that he peddles or sells, and all academics do this too. We all peddle stuff. You peddle stuff. I peddle stuff. I don't think it's like we're peddlers. We all live in capitalism. We all have these rules. However, his is, and I think you demonstrate this, his is one of, oh, look at me, I was a dissident, but I'm like, and I'm a radical, but ultimately toes the line on important things. So maybe we can kind of go through some of the things that he's discussed, and maybe kind of show the places, then sort of like explore people who may not have sort of taken up his mission. Because it's also, I think, part of an interesting thing that happens to sort of intellectuals, brand name intellectuals, celebrity intellectuals, which is, oh, what do you feel about this important person with a brain? Like, how do you feel about this topic? Like, how do you feel about this? So this is also like, you know, which came first, the chicken or the egg? Is it the celebrity intellectual that's the problem here? Or is it like the very notion itself? Or is it this guy in particular who's like, you know, as we'll see, a pretty reactionary in a lot of ways?
You know, just on that front, concerning the method that I use to approach these issues, because you're right that this is part of a larger book project. And Zizek himself, as I mentioned before, is more a symptom of a larger cultural and political economic phenomenon that I'm interested in tracking. And one way of describing that method is that it's a historical materialist analysis of the global theory industry. So it's recognizing that theory is not produced in a vacuum, or it's not produced just by individual subjects coming up with their own ideas. It is industrially produced by a series of material forces, and that capitalist foundations, the Central Intelligence Agency for that matter, and propaganda organizations have played a very important role in that production. And part of what I'm interested in tracing is the ways in which within the imperial core, right, within the Euro-American world that I grew up in and am largely trained within, there has been a consolidated kind of critical theory tradition that stretches back to the Frankfurt School, but includes a lot of French theorists, goes up to Zizek and Badiou and Agamben, and a lot of other figures that we could mention, is that this particular tradition is a product of the global theory industry, and that the central role that it has played historically is to shore up the non-communist left, meaning the compatible left, so that young people, students, professors for that matter, anyone involved in the kind of professional managerial class stratum who is living in the imperial core and wants to be up on radical theory is more or less obliged to read these people, right, and have something to say about them. And what this does is it creates a world in which the dominant radical discourse is a discourse that is has baked into it, more or less foundationally, a kind of anti-communism that has a deep and very dark history. There are tiny and minor exceptions to that that I could talk about, like Badiou supported the Cultural Revolution as a kind of, in China, as a kind of almost anarchist rejection of the party and state mechanisms and things like this. But for the most part, all of these thinkers, Hart and Negri would be another example of this, they really share these fundamental attributes. And another element of this that I know overlaps with your own work and interests and topics for the podcast is that this is a cultural imperialist project. So that if you are in the global South and you're an intellectual or a journalist, you know, you interact in the kind of general world of ideas, there is a kind of imperial uplift which makes it such that if you want to be part of the kind of international conversation, it's more or less a requirement that you know something about Foucault or Zizek or Derrida or someone like this. But you don't need to know anything at all about Walter Rodney or about just about anyone else I could think of, Claudia Jones or Fidel Castro, or you name it. There's a lot of people who are just excluded from this entire realm of debate. And what that does is it polices the left border of critique, but it does it at an objective as opposed to a subjective level. And what I mean by that is that there are coordinates for what the kind of dominant discourse is and what people need to know if they want to be in these conversations. And it creates a reality, which was very much my reality coming up, where I was interested in radical theory because I grew up as a farm kid working construction. I knew what exploitation was. I knew what oppression was. I knew a lot of horrible things about the world because I was living them in the capitalist empire. And I was gravitated towards what I thought were the most radical things, but I was not aware of the objective conditions that structured that radical discourse in such a way that all of the real discourses that were anti-imperialist and liberatory were actually largely excluded from those debates. And so I read a ton of Hart and Negri and Zizek and Badiou and all of these people and eventually realized, well, I'm looking in the wrong place. I'm looking in the place that the empire tells me I should look for radical theory. And of course, in retrospect, looking back on this, it's a little laughable how naive I was, right? But I think a lot of people, or at least some people, could relate to that level of naivete because the force of cultural imperialism is baked into the objective world so deeply that it's very, very difficult to see it. And so you go to radical bookstores, as I would often do, and what was the stuff I would come across? What were the radical, you know, conversations and debates? It was between Ernesto Laclau and Judith Butler and Slavoj Žižek. I remember very clearly when that book came out. And so all of that, I think, speaks to one of the central ways in which ideology functions, that ideology is not just about how subjects are individually formatted to perceive the world in particular ways, but that there are objective structures that compose the very limits, or I should say, the very horizons of one's subjective experience. And so a lot of my project is also a kind of this book project, of which the Zizek piece, but also the earlier piece that we discussed in the Frankfurt School, is part of a kind of critique of this deep ingrained cultural imperialism that particularly within the imperial court is very, very difficult to see. And another thing that I'll just add to this quickly is that this is also because that uplift, like if you want to become big and famous within the capitalist world, you got to give to the machine what it wants. And if you're an intellectual or an activist or a journalist from the global south, how are you going to become prominent within the broader world? Is it going to be by like exploring Walter Rodney and the history of resistance movements in Tanzania? No, probably not. It's going to be by engaging with liberal queer theory and the debates around Judith Butler, right? And so that uplift makes it such that a lot of those in the global south, if they're interested in socioeconomic ascension, public visibility, and things like that, they're going to have to become subjects who traffic in the perpetuation of this cultural and intellectual imperialism. And it's had a horrible, horrible consequences. I'll just give a shout out to Silvia Rivera-Kizikanki, who has a very good interview where she outlines how decolonial theory is a colonial product because it vets from the global south the theory that's acceptable within the imperial core and it excludes the theory that's not acceptable. Nestor Cohan is an incredible theorist and activist from Argentina. I don't think any of his work is translated into English. And there's lots of other examples that I could point to, and I'm sure that you could point to as well. So I think it's important as well when we're talking about these individual figures to always keep the larger system in mind and to keep the very large horizon of cultural imperialism, because then we can understand how it operates in order to better struggle against it, right? Because that's the whole point, not just understanding, but transformation.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like I don't know, I'm in this weird position now of playing devil's advocate in the sense of like defending, I don't want to defend these figures at all. And I feel that like, I mean, we should get into the articles, some of the things that some wacky things that Zizek has said, we should just like narrate them because they speak for themselves. But like before getting there though, I think I want to, especially about the last point about like, here are some famous names that you'll hear of and people from the global south are sort of forced to traffic in these names and sort of be part of it. And I think that's like partly true in the sense that, like, yeah, you have to learn the lexicon of, like, the prevailing lexicon of the field you want to study and be a part of. And I think that that's not really unique to, I feel that that's like a pretty like, you know, mild thing to say, that it's not like, yeah, you have to speak this language now. And the nature of that language, yes, it is predominantly one from issued and sort of where the rules and the grammar and the language and the words are determined in the global north, and they're dictated to people in the global south. But I think the issue here, though, is that, like, and I think this is the sort of hangover question from the previous episode, is that, like, what these canonical intellectuals, I mean, I don't think I phrased it that way, but these canonical figures and the canons that they're part of, right? Like, the very notion of canonicity, is that the problem here? Because when you induct someone into the canon of capital I important thinkers, you then place upon them as that, like, oh, tell us, dear sage, what to make of these protests in Iran. Like, Žižek has nothing to say. He's got nothing to offer. Like, he has nothing to offer that situation. And yet, here he is writing an article, right? Like, part of the issue here is a general sort of, like, hermeneutical, like, disease where people who are far removed from the things that happen in the world that are actually radical, like, or we can debate if they're radical or not in different countries, like, things that actually occur, because so little of what happens here actually is allowed to happen. Like, things are so stale here, and any amount of resistance is, like, crushed instantly and, like, murdered, literally, right? That, like, what's there to, like, what can you look at? And so people tend to sort of look outwards, and this is the nature of the podcast title, of my podcast title, and, like, make a career for themselves studying and analyzing and reporting on supposed radicalism of other places. And so, like, part of what happens is celebrity, and, like, what we've seen with this sort of, like, last 4 months with Iran, you've seen all these, like, celebrities doing these, like, performative acts of solidarity, but, like, nobody cares. Like, it's done purely for branding purposes and to show that you're part of some political in-group. But, like, what's the out-group here? Like, do you think there's, like, any large group of Islamic Republic supporters that are, like, public and, like, in Hollywood? Like, are they, like, no, there's no opposition. It's purely performative in the case of the West vis-a-vis Iran in that case. Now, I think what's interesting about Žižek is the lesson is another lesson in terms of celebrity and canonicity, but also multimedia. Because this guy was not your average theorist, right? Like, he's a cultural studies guy, right? Unlike a lot of his peers, like the people you named, Žižek was smart in the sense that he used his lens, the lens that he developed and fashioned. And this is what all academics do. This is what you're supposed to do. You fashion your own lens and you study texts. And, like, you do readings and you present analyses. And this is normal. Except Žižek had a unique blend of not just, like, the supposed, like, far left orthodox Marxism, which isn't true, we know that, but supposedly with the Lacanian sort of critical basis, right? And this fusion was his thing, but then it was also, like, the in-person articulation of those ideas. So he was, like, a traveling celebrity for, like, decades and decades, and still is. Like, he still, like, goes around, gives talks, and this is part of the nature of academic celebrities, that you had this, and this is before the days of podcasts and YouTube, obviously, is that you had to be flown around, and it was, like, a big deal, and there were thousands of dollars involved, and there were hotels, and there were dinners, and there were large talks, right? So what's interesting is that a guy like Žižek kind of expired. Like, he benefited from the early days of multimedia. So, like, Astra Taylor's biopic about him, like, that was great. That was Astra Taylor, right? Yeah, the movie about him was Astra Taylor, I think, is her name. It's called Žižek with, like, an apostrophe, I think. Yeah. But, like, that is a masterful act of translating academic research into non-academic media forms. And it only worked to bolster his celebrity. I mean, he was a big name by then, too. But, like, I found that it was, like, 2006 or something. Maybe it was earlier, actually. No, it was when I was an undergrad. It was earlier. But I feel that, like, he became a star in his own reality TV series. And we don't call it that because it's academia, so it has these lofty heights. But ultimately, it's a performance and it's a traveling show. And that's what Žižek does. Yeah, like, and that's what whatever. I have a show. I'm a guy who does a show. So who am I to make fun of Žižek for having a show? Now, am I lauded as a world important intellectual? No. So, like, it's kind of a nature of scale. But when you strip away this stuff, you realize that, like, like the celebrity intellectuals that we put so much gravitas on as like these wide sages, is that like they barely have any following outside of like the small world that you and I inhabit. And if they did, it's pretty like, oh, here's a weird guy talking about big words. Like it's not very engaged. So like, what's the, I don't know, is there any point investing so much energy deconstructing Slavoj Žižek when he like means so little to like most human beings?
Yeah, it's an interesting question, because for me, one of the things that's important is to examine the extent to which that particular tradition that I was talking about, from basically the Frankfurt School to Žižek and Bedieu, is a tradition that has had an enormous impact on intellectual circles, but also overflows into the world of journalism. You know, the Jacobin has just kind of lined up and supported the kind of Žižek line because they've worked with him in the past. And given the fact that they're social democrats, is, you know, it reveals a lot about Žižek's politics as well, and the complicity between the two. And the, but that whole kind of arc, if you will, is important because the intellectual world bleeds into much of the media and journalism world, as well as the activist world. And so one of the things that I'm interested in charting out, and this relates to earlier research projects that I was involved in, is the set of kind of psychological warfare operations that have been undertaken by a number of different governmental agencies and private agencies, for that matter, in order to redefine the very nature of the left. And I think that at its largest level, Žižek can be seen as a product of that. And the redefinition of the left that, of course, the U.S. empire has been invested in is a definition of the left where it's no longer, the socialist alternative is off the table. And so all that you have is at best a kind of progressive or even democratically socialist, but nonetheless ensnared within capitalist left. If you are able to construct a world in which the intelligentsia in the universities, the journalists, the media corps, the pundits who are invited on CNN, everybody is basically saying the same thing, that has an enormous impact in managing the mind of the masses. And so I couldn't agree more. In fact, the reason that I wrote the article on Žižek is because I had three friends who, in a conversation, they'd read some of my earlier pieces. They said, well, what about Žižek? And we kind of, I talked through what I thought about Žižek, and they said, you should really write this stuff because it's important for people to know this. But I wasn't convinced that it was the most important thing, because for me, the most important thing is this larger question of shoring up the compatible left and cutting out the socialist alternative, and how we can fight the weapon, fight the war of ideas in such a way that we reintroduce, as many people already have, obviously I'm not the only one, and most importantly, it's the activist world, has kept the socialist alternative very much alive and well. And so I think it's within that larger framework that you have to see things. The other thing, just cutting to another element that you touched on, is the whole issue of, you know, Žižek as a showman, and kind of what you're saying about the star system, is that I do think it's important that the cultural apparatus under capitalism functions in such a way that it is very convenient to have guaranteed values that are the stars that are situated at the top of the system. And those guaranteed values are people who have proven themselves to always toe the right line, to be radical recuperators, to appear radical, to say outrageous things, but at the end of the day, to basically, more or less, and again, there are some exceptions, Bedieu in particular would be an exception, and some of his political positions, I think, are good principled political positions. But a lot of the other people that we're talking about are not that at all, Žižek included. You know, support, he endorsed Trump for the election, you know, just as one example. But then at the same time, if you shore up those values at the top, what you have is the kind of golden calves of the global theory industry that cast an enormous shadow over everyone else. So that when there are top, you know, hot issues in the media, if it be Iran, if it be when NATO is bombing Yugoslavia, if it be the current U.S. proxy war in the Ukraine, or other such things, who do you go to? Do you go to an analyst who's doing historical materialist assessment of the geopolitical situation and situating the Ukraine within that? No. You go to this, you know, hatchet man, agent provocateur, showman, who's going to say some provocative shit that's going to sell your newspaper, drive up your advertisements, right? Drive up your revenue, and still at the same line, toe the ultimate line that a newspaper like The Guardian would toe, where Zizek regularly publishes some of his reactionary views. And so that's another really central function. The last thing that I'd say about that is that the category of intellectual commodity fetishism, I think, is really important. I'm sure a lot of your viewers and listeners know what commodity fetishism is, where you fetishize a particular commodity, meaning you kind of fall in love with its enchanted and magical power, and you have to get the latest iPhone or MacBook or whatever. But what that does is you lose sight of the social relations of production. So you don't see the mines and the, you know, of the, all the minerals and resources that go into the iPhone and the MacBook. You also don't see all the labor conditions and the child labor and slave labor and things like this. And intellectual commodity fetishism largely does the same thing, where you enshrine this kind of intellectual who's the star and the celebrity and who can do no wrong, while at the same time you mask the social relations of intellectual production and the fact that these people are actually products of a system that puts them forth as the showmen for radical theory within the capitalist world. And it is not surprising, of course, and it shouldn't be, that when you read through the work of all of these figures, they end up taking such profoundly reactionary positions, because that's precisely the reason why they're promoted by the system. And so it's very important to keep that in mind. If you want to find truly revolutionary theory, don't look for it within the global theory industry and the stars that are at the lead, the kind of front of it. Look instead at those intellectuals who have a very deep and organic link to global class struggle and are doing things for the masses of humanity, are doing things akin to what we'd call a kind of intellectual vanguardism in a very complex, and I think, you know, you'd have to unpack what I mean by vanguardism. It's you're in touch with the masses, but you're also bringing tools of analysis to the masses so that things can be brought into focus and we can move social movements forward, right? It's not just somebody saying, I'm right, I know everything, this is what we have to do. Not at all. And people like Walter Rodney are people like that, right? People like Domenico Lussordo is someone like that. But these aren't the brand figures of the theory industry, as much as at the same time, there's the process of recuperation in which, you know, Frantz Fanon is a great example of it, who's been basically, you know, recuperated by forces of the industry and really de-radicalized so that he can become much more palatable and become a consumer product. And maybe this is the last thing that I'll say, is that's another thing that Zizek has done and many of these other figures, is they've taken their most important insights from the Marxist tradition. But what they've done is a cultural mashup in which they've destroyed a lot of the substance and they've packaged it as a consumer product, so that people can swallow it. And what they don't recognize is, yeah, it's funny, it's kind of cheeky, it's provocative. This is a sugar-coated pill, so what you're actually swallowing is not Marxism. It's a reactionary discourse that takes insights from Marxism and bleeds them into these reactionary or liberal discourses. So it's a real problem. And I think one, you know, it's surprising how much this particular article blew up, but it seems like there must have been something kind of in the, I don't know, in the particular mix of what's going on now with online culture and contemporary social movements and anti-communism that made it such that a lot of people seemed like they were hungry and ready for putting the jester back in his place.
Yeah, I mean, I guess there's like a bigger, I guess the bigger thing than Zizek himself here is, you know, whither the intellectual classes, like the intellectual class, like what in, like, you know, in a prior era, like, I mean, I have this increasing suspicion that all hitherto existing periodizations are gonna disappear in like the next 10 years or like 15 years. And there will be only one historical kind of cultural periodization, and it will be a bifurcation, which is to say everything that happened before the internet and everything that happened after the internet, because ultimately we're talking about Zizek's ability to exist exist in like a academic formal world of essays and articles, a respectable world of professional psychoanalysis. I mean, he came from like the Slovenian school or whatever it was called, right? Like he had this training. I mean, whatever you want to say about his political positions, I mean, he's not, and yeah, I mean, you call him a charlatan and whatever. I mean, I think that part of what he is a charlatan, what it's the charlatanism is the idea of being a radical sage. I think that is a charlatan act. Does Zizek have specialized information and fields that I'm sure he does, but it's the question of how that specialization and how that intellect gets packaged to you and sold. And I think ultimately that the cry that the like the real issue that I feel that like I take issue with and you take issue with is the is that like at what cost is Zizek celebrity? Like you pay like the material thing here, going back to material thing, like flying a guy like Zizek, a scale of guy like Zizek, like or flying in a guy like Badiou as he would into UCLA. Like I met these guys at UCLA. I met Zizek personally. That was a character. But I also saw Badiou a bunch of times, you know, like these guys, and they also love LA. So they come to LA a lot. And like, but flying those guys there, that's a lot of salaries for grad students. Like there's a lot of money involved and it's earmarked for big names and it's earmarked for them. So they are part of an intellectual upper class, an aristocracy. Like that's totally the case that these guys, these celebrities, and this includes Spivak too. Like this is an aristocratic class, Butler too. And I mean, and this is not personally against them. I think this is just the material reality of their that this is like that when your name is that famous, when your brand is that big and recognized and like you have like 30 books to your name or some shit like that. Like you're in a world of your own. Like you have your own thing going. And I mean, there are people who have 30 books who aren't like them. Sure. I mean, I'm making a thing here, but like it's pretty hard to write that much and like, cause like, and like not, I would say like not sacrifice, you know, like sort of things of quality and merit and like whatever, and like sacrifice those like principles for like, you know, like the celebrity of publishing, of celebrity of getting your books out very quickly, of like getting your name, like as you described in your article, like getting your name slapped on an introduction, which is like a lot of this. Like I think the machinery of publication also backs these things up because, oh, I don't recognize that guy's name, but I do recognize the guy who introduces the guy I don't recognize. So that's good enough for me. And so like you can't, there's a point where you can't blame Zizek for like the culture he inhabits that is so like, just like, you know, golden retriever based, and that's like, oh my god, big shiny name, like I'm gonna look that way, and like, oh my god, that's a big, I mean, I saw some big name lectures, like for instance, like, and like I saw, for instance, like Judith Butler speak, I saw her speak in LA, and I also saw her speak in Berlin. At both like audiences, there were hundreds and hundreds of people there who were like hanging on to her every word. So like this appeals to people go, and like there's something in like these names, or at least these people's work, that attracts a large following. Now, is that necessarily a bad thing? I guess that's my next question. That like, is it the problem here, celebrity itself? That like any, and I feel like you are saying yes to this. You are answering yes with the general article. Is that like a culture as reactionary and horrible and terrible as imperialist as ours, as neoliberal, Anglo-American, late capitalist, whatever you want to call it, as like, if you are popular in this like piss bucket civilization, like then like what does that say about you? Like what does that like? And I feel that that's unfair at a certain point. Like maybe it is. Like maybe it's unfair to these big name celebrities whom I can name that like they didn't ask to be popular. Like it wasn't their fault that they became popular. They just did it. They just do their thing. So like maybe I want to like defend them, but at the same time though, like, is the very fact that they are popular in our reactionary society, is that proof that you should be like, I don't know about this? Like, why does a society that is so based around not radical things happening, that's like so profoundly not radical, like are that's part, that's like, I don't think we can separate this, is that the people reading the work of these radical thinkers, they live in a de-radicalized society. They live in a depoliticized society. We don't have a political society. It's been totally defeated. There are no serious oppositions. The only opposition that exists are the pockets of random groups, and a lot of which are infiltrated with government agents. So in a crazy way, the little opposition that exists is curated by the state itself and the security apparatus. That's how unradical our societies are.
Okay, well, yeah. Can I weigh in on that one? Because I disagree on that front. And I disagree because the activist world that I'm involved with, particularly young people, is so invigorating. And one of the things that I find unbelievably empowering is that there are a lot of people who know full well that given the combination of ecological degradation, the risks of World War III and nuclear annihilation, and the inability of the capitalist system to resolve its contradictions, there are a lot of people who know full well that there are problems with the system and that what we need is something like system change. And there are some extraordinary activists and unbelievable groups who are doing the most important work possible. I agree that, particularly within the US, I mean, it's a very reactionary political culture, but there are very powerful things going on from, I mean, the People Summit that was last year in LA to just recently the enormous anti-war protest in Times Square that was very important. There's a lot of examples that I could point to. Here in Philadelphia, the Fighting Hunger in Philadelphia, the Philadelphia Liberation Center and the Party for Socialism and Liberation organized food that was delivered free of charge to hundreds of families across the city. It's an enormous act, very much akin to, you know, the stuff that the Panthers were doing, the survival programs, and the Young Lords were doing the survival programs. So I don't share your revolutionary pessimism. Let me just put it this way, that way. We can return to that question if you want, but I did want to address the other two issues that you highlighted. One is one, I think, very useful concept for understanding the group of thinkers that we're talking about is the intellectual labor aristocracy. And of course, the labor aristocracy historically has been used by Engels and Lenin and others to point to the ways in which workers within the imperial core have been, there's a phenomenon of embourgeoisement, meaning that they have been turned partially into little bourgeois, not because they actually operate at the level of the bourgeoisie, but because of the unequal exchange between the imperial core and the colonial periphery. Their standard of living is far superior to that of wage workers in the global south. And so they're sitting on the top of the kind of, you know, the pyramid of imperialism, and they benefit from that. So an intellectual labor aristocracy is precisely situating these intellectuals as part of that labor aristocracy within the imperial core. And you're absolutely right. These people are given a very significant amount of money. There are junkets organized for them, keynotes, enormous conferences, everything they say is translated into multiple languages, on and on and on. And there are a very small number of people and many others who are fighting to, you know, get up into that leading crowd. And that part of what that does is it creates this celebrity phenomenon that situates these kind of icons of the bourgeois cultural apparatus as the most important theorists, as ones that everybody has to know. And I assure you that a lot of the people, because I've been to millions of these lectures, unfortunately back in my former self has even organized some of them for Judith Butler or Etienne Balibar or other figures of this ilk. A lot of the people who go to them precisely because there are the socioeconomic pressures of the bourgeois cultural apparatus that directs them to them and directs them away from other possible lectures. And I do think it's important. Some people rise to intellectual prominence because they're giving to the capitalist system what it wants, and they're finding these little niches. And I think you're absolutely right that in Zizek's case, it's a combination of both the industrialization of the intellectual world, beginning at least in World War II, but also the digitalization in, you know, the long 21st century. He was able to market himself, and his kind of dirtbag left persona fits perfectly with a lot of the digital and online cultures. And so he's found a really good niche for that. And those are the celebrities within that particular system. I'm not against, you know, recognizing that some people have skill sets that others can learn from in various ways. So what I said earlier about a kind of intellectual vanguardism, understood not as there are people who are just smarter than others or who are natural leaders or things like this. No, what I mean by that is people who can really learn from the masses, but frame an understanding of the world that allows us to harness the power of the masses and direct it in such a way that it can have real efficacy and real power over time. And there are people who have celebrity status because they've been able to do that. Meaning, their celebrity status is not because they gave to the capitalist cultural apparatus what it wanted and they therefore got promoted. It's instead because they found, they mobilized the tools of Marxist analysis and scientific analysis to provide tools of class struggle to the masses of people to fight and to win. Think about Ho Chi Minh, right? He's got a city named after him, right? Pretty important guy. What did he do? Was he writing books and getting invited to junkets? And was he at Berkeley? No, he wasn't. He was like digging tunnels underground in Vietnam, fighting for a people's liberation struggle that fought the most powerful imperial army, arguably in the history of the world at that point in time, from the point of view of an underdeveloped, structurally underdeveloped country, meaning it was underdeveloped by external forces of imperialism, and marshaled all of the theoretical and practical tools necessary to be a leader in that struggle. Does he deserve celebrity status? Absolutely. What is the nature of that celebrity status, though? That celebrity status is he is a fighter for the people. And that type of celebrity status isn't some kind of like golden calf, icon, no ever. It's somebody who's made enormous, enormous personal sacrifice for the well-being of humanity and has advanced the project of human liberation. So when I learn and study people like Ho Chi Minh, and I could give, Thomas Sankara or Fidel Castro or other people like that, the people who've made enormous sacrifices for the advancement of humanity. And they are definitely celebrities in my book. They've done something that is incredible for as just a kind of testament to the ability of human beings to do things that certainly might have seemed to many impossible, like defeat the U.S. Empire, as well as the French Empire and the Japanese Empire and everybody else that Ho Chi Minh and, of course, the Vietnamese people who are the driving force behind that entire revolution fought off, right?
I mean, I want to share your I don't want to say, what is it, it's kind of anti-pessimism. I wouldn't call it optimism, but it's definitely anti-pessimism, what you were saying. And I want to share it. And I don't want to be cynical, but I'm saying, but part of me fears that we've put the cart before the horse in the sense that, like, radical mass education is so far down the line of such a reactionary country like the U.S. I mean, I think that the base, I mean, whatever, this is a different question. Because ultimately, like, what's at stake in a case like Zizek is, what is influence? Like, what is the nature of influence today? Like, what does that mean? Are you, like when we use the word, like, oh, he's, in, like, someone used the word influencer for me, which I was like, what? I run a stupid show that like 3,000 people listen. Like, you're kidding me? Like, you think you think I write op-eds? You think I have any like institutional power? I have institutional power over my dog. Like, that's the institutional power I have. I take her to the dog, to the vet. Like, that's my institutional power. Whereas like there are people who have way less, let's say, following online, which is like a stupid measure, who have immense institutional power, who can get books published, who can get like, who can have conferences organized, who can like fly people around the world. Like, that's material. I'm superstructure, right? Like, I'm just a guy who hangs out in the superstructure. Like, that's it. And so, I mean, I feel that like, at least with my mission, the mission of this show is to somehow just provide an opportunity to talk about these figures who don't get as much play. And I feel that like an episode like this is important. And I know we are pushing time. We have 7 minutes and I don't even have them. So like, I think, maybe we can close with, what do you think are some of the most egregious, crazy things that Zizek has said that people should know about, that they don't know about, that they should know about?
Well, there's a very, very long list. And of course, my list, even in the article, was far from exhaustive. I mentioned that he endorsed Trump. He really doubled down. He accused Henry Kissinger, of all people, of being a pacifist. Because he suggested maybe some minor negotiations around the U.S. proxy war in the Ukraine. He's a big NATO supporter. Obviously, doesn't know the history of NATO because NATO was involved in the secret stay-behind armies that have been very well documented by Daniel Ganser, basically committed acts of terrorist violence across Europe, blamed it on the communists and the socialists so that they could be rounded up and thrown in prison. Zizek's also, all the stuff that he said about Hitler and the positions on Nazism are very, very questionable. He's referred to communism, of course, as being one of the most horrendous kind of political, social occurrence in the 20th century. And he's also just made flatly, like, incorrect statements about many, many, many things. In his view of the world, Xi Jinping, the current leader of China, is somehow the equivalent to the kind of corrupt capitalist gang of Putin and Erdogan and others. His level of geopolitical intelligence is very, very low. And then there are, of course, and I didn't go into this in the article, but there's lots of great critiques of him for his transphobia, for his kind of patriarchal anti-feminist politics, and a lot of other things. One of the things that Zizek does, and that's one of the reasons that he's such a problematic figure, is that he also says everything in its opposite all of the time. And so he'll say these really heinous and reactionary things and then kind of try to slough it off as a joke or just chalk it up to being a provocateur. And that allows him then to kind of rely on, you know, he's like the horrible person at the Thanksgiving, or I shouldn't say Thanksgiving because I don't really celebrate it, but like at a dinner table with relatives who is going to say the most, the kind of cruel and mean things to your aunts and uncles, but provide them with a thin cover of jocular humor so that he can't actually be accused of just being a prick and an asshole who's going after family members. And so the way in which he even uses humor, I find quite disingenuous.
Tell you a wonderful story, simple one. It happened to me a year ago, around the corner here in the bookstore. I was signing a book of mine. Two black guys came, African-Americans. I don't like the term. My black friends also not, because for obvious reasons. It can be even more racist. But the point is, and they asked me to sign a book, and seeing them there, I couldn't resist the worst racist remark. When I was returning the books to them, I told them, you know, now I don't know which one is for whom, you know, you blacks like yellow guys, you look all the same. They embraced me and they told me, you can call me nigger. You know, when they tell you this, it means we are really close. They instantly got this. Oh, another stupid problem I had. At some talk, there was a mute and deaf guy, and he asked if a translator can be there. And I couldn't resist it. In the middle of the talk, in front of 200-300 people, I said, what are you doing there, guys? My idea was, if you watch the gestures of the translator, it looked to me as some obscene messages or what. The guy laughed so much, we become friends. Not all, and some old stupid lady reported me for making fun of crippled people. It was so, didn't she see? That's how I became friend with the guy.
I mean, when you talk as much as he does, you're gonna say incorrect things. You're gonna make wild accusations. You're gonna say wacky things. I mean, he debated Peterson. Like Jordan fucking Peterson, but that's the easiest thing in the world. Jordan fucking Peterson has the brain of a stuffed lobster. Like, he's a moron. So, like, taking him on, it made him look... And I watched the video of it, and I was like, oh, boy. If Zizek, the dumbass, could take this guy apart, like, God, this guy is really slow. Because ultimately, it doesn't take much, but it's like, a guy like Zizek is popular because he says wacky stuff. So, like, the same thing that makes Howard Stern popular, the same thing that makes Rush Limbaugh popular, the same thing that makes, like, whatever, the fucking Cumtown guys popular. That's what makes him popular. It's just overlaid with Lacanian psychoanalysis and, like, allusions to Soviet Marxism. Like, that's it. Like, that's really it. It's not very deep. I mean...
Well, it's a leftist version. It's a good point of comparison, right? Because that form of provocation... gets views on digital platforms, and people love to, I don't know if you can say shit watch is the equivalent to shit post, but you know what I mean, right? Just watch shitty stuff. And the fact that he's constantly just spewing out this dirtbag left provocation is something that works really well on, you know, Twitter and social media in general and digital platforms and whatnot. And you're absolutely right that it is kind of the rhetorical equivalent to a lot of the right-wing versions that you get of that. And just like the right-wing, they kind of, he'll end up saying everything and it's opposite and self-contradicting, but it doesn't matter.
Yeah, it doesn't matter. You can say anything. You can say anything. It doesn't matter. Like, in this realm, no one's going to hold you accountable. No one, like, what, there's some court that they go to? They take you to night court? and Judge Harry T. Anderson takes you on the truth, like, no one gives a shit. But if you're just, like, popular enough, if you can get somebody to make you a documentary that's, like, shows how weird your sock collection is, like, you can make anything out of anyone, I've come to, like, learn. Like, online, I've learned this, too. Like, a lot of astroturfing follows the same logic. Anyways, Gabriel, we have a one-minute hard limit. You gotta go. Thank you again. Really appreciate your time. I'll link the article, and we'll see you soon.
Okay, thank you so much.